This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. In 1831, a young French writer arrives in Michigan, hoping to get a glimpse of untouched American wilderness. Alexis de Tocqueville sets out on horseback from Detroit to Saginaw with the help of native guides. They travel through dense virgin forests and swampland and finally emerge on the banks of the Saginaw River, where de Tocqueville reflects on the future of this land. He wrote, "In a few years, these impenetrable forests will have fallen. The noise of civilization and of industry will break the silence of Saginaw." He had no idea. For part three of his series, An Idea on the Land, Dustin Dwyer tells the story of how the forest of Michigan fell and built the state we know today.
I've been trying to hold a picture in my mind of what de Tocqueville must have seen. There are no pictures of Michigan before the trees fell. All we have are the words and maps left by the Europeans and their descendants. They tell of a land covered by ancient forests. In the southern half of Michigan, maple, beech, oak, hickory, ash, American chestnuts, too, giants that once spread across the eastern U.S. in groves with trunks 5 feet thick. American chestnuts are nearly extinct now, most of them killed off by blight. Up north, the trees were different. White pines and hemlocks with massive trunks that shot straight to the sky, branching only at the very top, 100 feet above ground. Today there's only one place in lower Michigan where you can see a forest like that.
So we are about to walk into our old growth forest. We have the largest stand of old growth trees left in the lower peninsula.
Hillary Pine is a historian with the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. She's showing me around Hartwick Pines State Park, just north of Grayling. And yes, Pine really is her last name. We're on a paved trail. The forest around us has the feeling of a cathedral. Tall columns, a high ceiling, a rare kind of calmness.
Unfortunately, today, there's only about 49 acres left. For those that don't know, most of Lower Michigan's forests were clear cut during the logging era, and that was about 1850 to 1910.
This logging era got underway just as the Erie Canal opened, and just as white settlers gained control of the land of Michigan from its indigenous people. These settlers and speculators saw opportunity in the trees. They called the white pine green gold. And it's not a stretch to say that the wealth created during the logging boom is what made Michigan possible today. The wealth in wood turned into other kinds of wealth. In 1858, a man named Henry Crapo moved from Boston to Flint to get into the lumber business. He made a bunch of money. So did his grandson, William Durant, the founder of General Motors. When Henry Ford launched his first car company in Detroit, the money came from William H. Murphy, another lumber baron. When Ford split from that company, Murphy stayed in the automobile business and renamed the company Cadillac. Michigan is the state that put the world on wheels, but the financing came from the forests. Hillary Pine says the result on the land was devastating.
And it's not something a lot of us think about, because a lot of us think about Michigan as having these beautiful big forests. And we don't necessarily think of the Michigan of 100 years ago that it was ugly. If you wanted to go on a road trip from Grand Rapids up to like Mackinac City, it was ugly, looked like a wasteland. There'd be tree stumps with their roots exposed because erosion was a big problem, and it was not a pretty place.
There are photos of this, barren landscapes strewn with branches tinted in sepia. The loggers didn't take everything. They left behind the smaller trees, the gnarled branches, the pine needles, just enough to set off massive wildfires. On October 8, 1871, the Great Lakes states were consumed with fire. Most of us have heard of that day because it's the day Chicago burned. But Chicago wasn't even the worst of it. One fire started in eastern Wisconsin and reached parts of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. It's known today as the Peshtigo Fire, and it's still the deadliest wildfire in U.S. history. And there were other fires that day. An estimated 2.5 million acres across Michigan burned. And 10 years later, in 1881, the Thumb Fire burned another 1 million acres. It killed more than 280 people and sent a plume of smoke all the way to the East Coast. The worst of these fires ended over a century ago, but the land of Michigan is still recovering.
This was a region-wide human, I don't want to call it a disaster, but a major disturbance.
Newt Nadelhofer is a biologist who studies forest ecology. He directs the University of Michigan Biological Station. It sits on about 100 acres of land along Douglas Lake on the northern tip of Lower Michigan.
You know, when visitors go up there, they think it's a beautiful, pristine place, but it's really sort of a early middle-aged forest in terms of forest life cycles.
Pretty much all the forests we see in northern Michigan are like that. Most of us can't tell the difference, but there is a difference. Younger forests have less diversity of plants and animals, Nadelhofer says.
So we have a much simpler and younger forest on average.
But we do have a forest. That's because 100 years ago, after the forests were destroyed, the soil washed out, the remains sent up in apocalyptic flames, the people of Michigan had a change of mind. The clear-cutting stopped. Eventually, a massive effort began to replant the trees. The Civilian Conservation Corps went acre by acre, planting millions of trees. Today, the trees have grown tall, and you can still spot them in stretches of forest where pine trees grow in perfect rows. And a few people acted to save the forests that still stood. People like Karen Hartwick, who saved Hartwick Pines.
She's from Grayling. She grew up knowing that this old growth forest was here.
Hillary Pine tells me the story back on the old growth trail at the state park. Karen Hartwick was born Karen Mickelson, the daughter of a lumber baron. Pine says in high school, Karen meets Edward Hartwick, and they eventually marry. Hartwick gets into the lumber business too, but when World War I breaks out, he goes to Europe to serve his country. He never comes back. In her grief, Karen decides to make him a memorial. But it wouldn't be another statue or a plaque. She wants to memorialize him in land. Then Pine says Karen Hartwick discovers her father's lumber company still owns an 8,000-acre patch of land near Grayling. And part of that land had never been logged. It was a small part, not worth the effort of setting up an entirely new operation to bring the trees down. The lumber company doesn't want it anymore.
They have been trying to sell it to the state of Michigan, and the state will not buy it. So Karen swoops in, she buys it. In today's money, she pays about $600,000 for it, for 8,000 acres. And she immediately the next day gives it to the state.
She gives it with some stipulations. She says the trees here can't be touched. Nothing can be harvested. If a tree gets a blight, the blight stays until the tree falls. And when the tree falls, the log stays there and rots, just like trees used to do. That log becomes a refuge for bugs, mushrooms, small mammals. Trees support life long after they die. And why does all this matter for us today? Because our ideas about forests, our ideas about land, they last long after we're gone. The early white settlers of Michigan had certain ideas. Karen Hartwick had certain ideas. Their ideas are still playing out on the land more than a century later. The ideas we have about land and water will play out for centuries after we're gone. And these ideas, they're never really just about land. They're not about forests or trees or little squirrels living in dead logs. They're ideas that affect people. And the consequences for people can last a long time too.
Tomorrow, Dustin Dwyer will bring us the final story in his series, An Idea on the Land, the lasting legacy of the Burt Lake burnout. That's tomorrow on Stateside.